Thanks very much, Professor Krugman. I wouldn't say what would the Keynes, think of what Professor Krugman said, but I imagine he would approve, hopefully. But what matters is what you guys think or what you want to raise at this point in time. So may I open it for general questions? And yes, okay. Please. Martin?
Martin Wolf, Financial Times. Zero bound. We have zero bound at the short end. We don't have zero bound at the long end, though, as you say, it's been falling. So how effective in this situation do you think is central bank policy targeted at lowering the long rate?
Right. Okay. The thing I came into this thinking about that, and by the way, this is the funny thing about this, by the way, is that there was a debate about these very issues going on at Princeton around 2000. There was, because there were several of us who were very concerned about the Japanese example, and that included me, Mike, Lars Svensson, who's now back in Sweden, and our department chairman now running the world, and there was a dispute: how much must the policy operate just through expectations? Because can you only get monetary policy traction in an environment like this if you can change people's expectations about future inflation and such? And how much can the central bank, just by buying long-term debt, move stuff? So my argument would be, I was always a skeptic about that form, about Bernanke-style quantitative easing, which he was advocating way back when. Because what the Fed... sorry, I'm Americanizing it, but what you'll get the same thing applies, obviously, elsewhere. What the Fed can do, the Fed can essentially control the short-term interest rate because that is the margin of substitution between stuff that only the Fed can create, bank reserves and currency and other stuff. It can, at best, influence other rates. It's not the same thing. It's not the same level of control. And the thing that it has to change is much bigger. Right? If you're trying to move the spread between the short term, if you're trying to move the short term interest rate, you're trying to change the monetary base, which in normal times in the U.S. is about $800 billion. If you're trying to move the long term rate, then you're having to shift the supply and demand for bonds, and we're talking about model of a market that's tens of trillions of dollars large. So it's a much, much bigger thing that you have to move. And to a large extent, long term interest rates are, you know, expected future short rates. So you're operating on whatever margin there is between that and the actual long rate. So it's a risk thing. So I think it's hard. It would take, let's put it this way, it would take enormous interventions to really get a lot of traction on those long rates. And the problem is, we could do it, but they would be very large. And we've already seen the firestorm of resistance that the Fed got over what was actually a quite small intervention relative to what would be needed. So the answer is, I think I'm for it because at this point there doesn't seem to be anything else we can do. But there's no reason to believe it's especially effective.
David Vines from Oxford, you're well known for your argument that the fiscal stimulus should be continued at the moment in the U.S.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could explain to people how to think about that. In the following sense, when will it end, and how can we know how much, if we're going to solve this continuing the fragile recovery by fiscal, is this just a black hole of public debt rising and rising and rising? People like you and me don't think it is, but I'm not sure how to explain when it will stop, when the balance sheets will right themselves, and how that argument can simply be put across to people.
Yeah. Well, yeah, putting it simply across to people has been the problem all along, right? I'm very much, I'm of the St. Augustine school on fiscal adjustment. You know, oh Lord, make me chaste and continent, but not yet. That this is not a time when you want to be retrenching. This is a time when you want to be spending, precisely because we're up against the zero lower bound. And so there's nothing else that works. And in fact, if you cut spending in an environment like this, not only does it depress the economy, but it actually doesn't even work very well at the job of reducing deficits because the economy contracts and the deficits fall, the revenue falls, safety net spending rises. And because there's pretty good reason to think that a depressed economy actually hurts you in the long run as well, the people who've been unemployed long enough become unemployable, that low business investment hurts future production. It does not take very outlandish numbers to, I've done this for the United States, not for the UK, but for the United States, it does not take very outlandish numbers to come to the conclusion that slashing federal spending right now actually worsens the US fiscal position, that any savings you get up front are more than offset by both short-term and long-term revenue losses. So that's a reason not to do it now. Then the question is, when does it end? And the answer is it ends when balance sheets have improved enough so that the economy is close enough to full employment that you would want to start raising that short-term interest rate. And at that point, you say, well, look, let's not raise the short-term interest rate. Let's cut back on the spending instead. Nobody knows how long that takes. And if you ask, how did we get out of this last? How did we get out of that blue spike? We did not do the experiment of a sustained fiscal expansion until it was no longer necessary. What we did was a humongous fiscal expansion, known as World War II, which was significantly monetized, and we had a roughly 70% rise in the price level, which sharply reduced the real burden of debt, and emerged from that. No longer needing to run deficits to maintain full employment. So, yeah, I mean, there's. If you ask me, what do I think could really end this? It would be, let's find some reason to spend vast amounts and get a period of significant inflation to erode those debts. And we don't really know. Our program of moderate fiscal stimulus to keep the economy afloat, we don't know how that ends. Japan has actually essentially been doing that, and their lost decade is now I guess in its 19th year. And on the other hand, if I said people have lost money by betting that U.S. interest rates were going to rise, people have lost an awful lot of money by betting again and again that Japanese rates were going to rise, and their 10-year rate was 1.14 last I looked.
Just comparing your commentaries during, on Japan back then, and your commentary now, I may be wrong, but my impression is that at that time you were much more forceful on inflation. And now it seems that fiscal policy is the headline. Is that because you think that fiscal policy is the only way to get to inflation in the end, or?
No.
Do you think there is a case to be made that just increasing the inflation target for central banks would be a good idea and it could be done aside from fiscal policy?
Yeah, for those who don't know, back in 1998, I was arguing that the right policy for Japan was to announce a significantly high inflation target, 4 or 5%, and basically bootstrap, and do it with monetary policy. When push came to shove, actually Mike Woodford gave a very good talk this morning, which turns out encapsulated near the end pretty much why I ended up singing a different tune for the United States in this crisis, which is that to get monetary policy of that kind, if I thought we could credibly get a commitment by the Fed to 5 years of 5% inflation, I would take it in a heartbeat. In January 2009, I did not think we could do, in fact, get that. And we could not get it for a couple of reasons. One is the crisis was still fairly new. It would not be easy to get the Fed to agree to that. Be hard to make it credible. How do you make it not? How do you convince central banks, particularly central bankers, who stock and trade is price stability, to say that they will commit to maintaining the inflation even after the crisis is over, which is what you have to do to make that work? And so it turns out to be very much harder than you know, us outsiders critiquing the Japanese. I should say I think a bunch of us should actually probably travel to Japan and offer apologies. Faced with the same kind of problem, we are doing even worse than significantly worse than the Japanese did. The fiscal policy, Mike said it exactly. The fiscal policy, I'll give two of the three reasons. Fiscal policy has the two great advantages that it requires that you do extraordinary things when the economy is in extraordinary difficulties, not that you commit to do them after the difficulties are over. So it requires that you do stuff that's extraordinary at the time that you have the crisis. And it does not rely on expectations. You don't have to be able to change people's expectations. If the government goes out there and hires 3 million people for the Works Progress Administration, those 3 million people are put to work. You don't have to make people believe that some policy is going to be continued for the next 10 years. So that's something like that, a little more inchoate, was why I was pushing for fiscal policy, because I did not think that 4 months after the fall of Lehman we could get the Fed to fundamentally change its medium-term targets, and I thought we could get a really significant fiscal stimulus out of Congress. Turns out I was wrong. Or at least, let's put it this way, at least they didn't try to do that. So what we actually got was a very partial, inadequate stimulus, which has turned out to be a political economy disaster, because we managed to get the sense that fiscal stimulus has failed without actually having even really tried it. And so the result is complete paralysis. What do you say?
Could I ask you, as an American commentator, would it be politically possible for the government to start green-friendly infrastructure, either through itself or through the private sector, both at the federal and at the state level, and instead of financing this by issuing bonds, just tell the Federal Reserve to honour its checks until unemployment has, say, been halved, and then think about balanced budget multipliers or raising taxes in order to... it's not possible.
No, I'm... all right. Taking off whatever economics hat I was wearing, I guess we're... Oh, my fault. Turns out I need to keep hitting that thing. Taking off, I spend more time than is good for my mental health actually paying attention to the U.S. political debate. And what we have is, I think basically everything is blockaded. It's worth remembering that the House subcommittee that oversees the Federal Reserve is now headed by Ron Paul, who is a gold standard advocate. I spent some time in my column yelling at my former department head because I think I'm doing him a favor, because he gets all of this yelling at him from the right. I think he probably needs to be able to point to somebody yelling at him from the left, of which there are not many. But no, the political pressures, I think that is a surprise, actually. There were some, in the early stages of the crisis, there were some, I call them post-monetarists, right? If we've got post-Keynesians, they're post-monetarists who no longer think that M2 is the be-all and end-all, but basically believe that with sufficient effort, monetary policy can do the thing, and want the Fed to target nominal GDP or something. And they tend to be relatively politically conservative, and they thought that was the thing. And they've discovered that they have no home. That there is no, in the political system, they have no home. The political opposition in the United States is both balanced budget and, or at least spending cuts. Whether they really want to balance the budget is another question. But what is for fiscal austerity and hard money, and with no give, and I can't think of anything along the lines you're suggesting that would fly in the debate. We just and again, partly because of the things I talked about at the beginning. There's not just ignorant congressmen, but a substantial number of credentialed economists will tell you that you know, we don't need more stimulus, that expansionary monetary policy is not warranted. And so there's really, and in fact, even that in principle, these things cannot work. So no, I don't think there's I can't think of anything short of some dramatic disaster that will break the political deadlock right now.
Thank you. Okay, the bond market vigilantes haven't turned up yet.
Right.
But why are you so confident that that they won't eventually show up if there's no fiscal consolidation?
Yeah.
The other a very closely related question, certainly here in the UK, is to ask, you know, why are you so confident that the confidence fairy
right.
won't keep us out of a double-dip recession?
Yeah. For people who don't know, this is I think I can claim credit for certainly for the second of those. So I've been arguing that a lot of policy right now is being based upon two invisible sets of characters: the invisible bond vigilantes, who are we assume that we must slash now to satisfy the bond vigilantes, except for the United States and the UK, and there's no hint of them. Interest rates have remained low, and that's yet, of course, and that the confidence fairy, that I think is my coinage, that if you slash spending, that will raise confidence, and therefore the economy will actually expand. On the bond thing, just as an intellectual point, the argument that borrowing will cause people to doubt your solvency is quite different intellectually from the simple crowding out argument. So it's not the same story, although I think a lot of the people who started with the crowding out argument sort of took refuge in the argument, oh, well, actually it's going to cause a loss in confidence instead. Now, you can't be certain. I guess what I would say, though, is let's put it this way. Have we seen anybody not quite right, but we've seen quite few cases of countries that have been able to maintain confidence by austerity in the slump. That is, you have to worry about that concern. You have to not only worry that people will lose confidence in your long-run fiscal probity, but you have to believe that what you do to the budget this year is likely or has a reasonable chance of being make or break for maintaining that confidence. So you have to believe there's basically an argument that you must inflict pain right now, even though the macroeconomics for that are bad, to convince markets that you're serious. And so there's this whole psychodrama that people are playing out about what the hypothetical bond vigilantes are really thinking about, which is not based on any evidence. I look at the United States, which I know fairly well. I don't know the UK budget issues quite as well. The U.S. has an enormous long-run budget problem, which is primarily a healthcare cost problem. And so if I were making a rational calculation about U.S. solvency, I'd be asking, do we have the political will to seriously address the healthcare cost problem? And I would say that the size of the budget deficit in fiscal 2012 is virtually irrelevant to that. And, you know, at current interest rates, you know, the real interest rate on long-term debt is below 1%. So run an additional $1 trillion of deficit, or $1 trillion of deficit more or less, ends up being $10 billion of future interest costs, which is less than a tenth of a percent of GDP. So you really, by the arithmetic, you should not care at all about what happens to the deficit this year or next year. The investors should not care. They should care what are the prospects for healthcare cost control. Plus, we're going to need more revenue. So if the long-run solution to the U.S. budget problem is a 5% VAT plus Medicare learning to say no, then what you should be concerned about is what are the signs that political process is willing to do that? The willingness to slash nutritional aid for pregnant poor women this year should have no bearing at all on whether you think the U.S. is solvent. So the whole argument that says we must do austerity to keep the bond vigilantes at bay is based upon the argument that somehow your willingness to inflict pain on on parts of the federal budget that are not the source of our long-run budget problems is somehow going to be a signal to the market's budget willingness to do the right thing. And that's basically why I don't buy it. Now, I think there is a reasonable chance that at some point the market, whoever that is, the market is a bunch of 28-year-old guys who don't know anything. But at some point, the market will decide that the United States is a banana republic. Because there's a pretty good argument saying that we actually are. But I don't think that what we do on the budget over the next year is going to make the difference there.
Excuse me. One thing we are or are not going to do with more or less incoherence is have some legislation with respect to the debt ceiling, not within the next 12 months, but within, say, the next 3 months.
Yeah.
And in terms of expectations, attitudes, and consequences from market back to economy and into public policy, I'd be very interested in your point of view.
Yeah.
Currently updated.
Yeah. Until I read some news this morning, I was pretty sure that we were actually going to fail to raise the debt ceiling and go into temporary default. It now sounds a little bit, if I read the tenor of some of the news stories, like the Speaker of the House has actually started to recognize the gravity of this and may pass some brief stopgap rise. And by the way, that's the kind of thing. If your concern is that the United States is a banana republic, that we have crazy politicians who are totally irresponsible, failure to raise the debt ceiling is the kind of thing that might actually be the piece of evidence that makes people say, oh, yeah, they really are that bad. I'm really worried. The debt ceiling is scary, and it's scary actually not just because of what it might do to faith in the United States and so on, but because Treasury bills are a special thing in the world financial system. Treasury bills are the gold standard, whatever. They are the ultimate safe asset, and if suddenly they're not, that's a huge number of financial arrangements are discombobulated. I guess that's as technical as I can get. So this is scary stuff. But not surprising. I mean, people who kept on saying, "Oh, this is going to get resolved," have not been paying attention to U.S. politics these past 10 years, let alone this last year. And I think it's 6 weeks. I think we have 6 weeks to go before we really, we're strictly speaking, we're past it already, but they're using maneuvers. But I think early August is when the,
I'm Himanshu from Judge Business School. I want to ask you if you believe that part of the reason for current crisis was the extended low interest rate policy by Greenspan in the U.S. And if you do, can you suggest what can be done now to prevent such a crisis happening down the road due to the expansionary policy right now?
I'm sorry, expansionary. The expansionary which policy?
The expansionary monetary policy.
Yeah. Okay. Mostly, I don't believe that. There is an argument that says that interest rates were kept too low for too long, basically between 2002 and 2005. It's not a case you can make on the conventional macro grounds. The U.S. economy still had fairly high unemployment. Inflation was contained. Why would you have wanted to raise rates? But there are people who argue that either that some interpretation of the Taylor rule, I've never understood. John Taylor, who came up with this rule for setting monetary policy, he basically invented a rule out of thin air that looked kind of plausible to him. And now he said ever since that if you don't follow the specific parameters that I made up once upon a time, you're doing the wrong thing. And I don't think that's a sensible way to make policy. But more to the point, maybe the Fed should have been looking at asset prices and said, there's something going on here. Of course, the problem was that the Fed was in deep denial that there was any problem with asset prices. Right up into the pretty near the peak of the housing bubble, you had Alan Greenspan not only denying that there was any serious housing bubble, but denying that such a thing was even possible. How could it have been different? But if you look at the run-up in asset prices was far more than should have been justified by the extent to which interest, if you think interest were too low, they were too low for by 100, 200 basis points for a few years. That should not have led to an explosive rise in asset prices. And you can say, well, that's how markets go crazy, the markets do go crazy, but then I think your focus should be on what is it about markets that makes them that liable to go so badly wrong. I guess the way I'd say is that a financial system that can only avoid calamity if you always have extremely wise policy on the part of the central bank is a financial system that's going to run on the rocks pretty soon. You just can't count on that. And so, and the financial system that the United States had in 1980 would not have responded. I mean, we actually had a period of too low interest rates in the 70s, right? We had inflation problems, but we did not have financial crisis problems. And it was the fact that we had this unregulated Wild West financial system that made it so vulnerable. So my answer is that this is not, by all means, I'm happy to blame Alan Greenspan for as much as you like, but but I think that to lay the blame for this crisis on monetary policy presupposes an extremely fragile, extremely unstable financial system, and that the lesson you should really take is that we should have a better regulated financial system so that a couple of years of slightly off-Fed policy don't cause that much in the way of a problem.
Applying the logic of your analysis to the Eurozone crisis and to Greece, you mentioned where Greece, the Greek government appears to be run by the IMF and the European Central Bank at the moment. Would you say that the IMF is also run by bond vigilantes, or if the IMF is staffed by PhDs and economists, do they not realise that the market is a bunch of 28-year-old young men? And then the second part of that question is, if Greece defaults, is it going to be the big crisis in Greece and in Europe that everybody's saying?
Well, so a couple of, the IMF, by the way, has been the research analysis coming out of the IMF has been actually excellent. The IMF is one of the beacons of sensible analysis, though it doesn't always translate into their policy recommendations. But that's actually, the world is smaller than it should be. It's, when I say the IMF, it's, the research, the analysis is not coming out of 28-year-olds who don't know anything. They're coming out of my former colleague, Olivier Blanchard, who is doing a wonderful job. But the policy recommendations were fairly flexible, actually, relatively, certainly compared with past IMF history. And I was actually quite liking a lot of the stuff that the managing director was doing, and unfortunately, it turns out he was doing some other stuff, so we have a problem. On the Greece story, you have to say that what the IMF's role in Greece, the IMF is being extraordinarily forgiving in the Greek situation relative to its own past policies. The amount of credit it's extending on very weak conditionality, not so much on the Greeks as on the Europeans, is amazing, and I think raises some real questions about, is this really an international monetary fund, or is this just an extension of the European community? But I think the problem, the Greek thing is, I actually hate the Greek story because Greece turns out to be a really sui generis. I've protested against the Hellenization of our economic debate because Greece really was irresponsible and really is very problematic and is not doing, it is. I think Papandreou is a good guy, but they're not managing to fulfill their promises, though it's not clear that even if they did, it would work. But the broader thing, the Eurozone is having exactly the problems, or it's having the problems that Eurosceptics worried about from the beginning, except on an even bigger scale than the Eurosceptics imagined. We worried a lot about asymmetric shocks and how would you adjust, and we just had the mother of all asymmetric shocks with these gigantic capital inflows into the peripheral economies that then go into reverse. There's no good answers for that with a fixed exchange rate. It turns out that the absence of fiscal integration is a much bigger deal than I think even I realized. So I've been using it. If you look at, by the numbers, Nevada and Ireland turn out to be quite similar. They don't look similar, but the scale of the housing bust is similar, the whole picture. But In Nevada, although it's terrible, the healthcare, Medicare and Social Security are being paid for by somebody else. A fair bit of the financial cost is ending up being borne either by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or by Fannie and Freddie, by the U.S. government lending agency. So you don't have any of those backstops that would make a single currency more tolerable. And it's a mess. I don't know how the Greek endgame plays out. I was very influenced by Barry Eichengreen's classic analysis a few years ago of why the euro was irreversible, which was that any country that even contemplated leaving would subject itself to a banking collapse. And so therefore it was unthinkable. Now we have the real possibility that the banking collapse may happen first, in which case a partial breakup of the eurozone becomes conceivable. On the financial fallout, the Germans, the French, the UK has the resources to bail out their banks if it turns out that there's a lot of losses from Greece. So we're really not talking about unaffordable losses being imposed on the financial system. We're just talking about the possibility of a coordination failure, a failure to act effectively on policy. And so it's a lot of money, but it's not that much money relative to the size of the eurozone economy, which is enormous. So I guess I don't think it'll be a second Lehman, because I think that Lehman wouldn't have been Lehman if people had not been as unaware of the risks as they were on September 15th, 2008. I think because they're aware of the risks, it's not going to be as bad as all that, I think. I would still think it's probably a good idea to be wearing a crash helmet when it happens.
I'll try to. Skif Pankov, undergraduate from economics faculty. Going back to the financial sector, if we're talking about Minsky and if we're talking about the hypothesis of instability, is it worth kind of being afraid of a next bubble if there were to be a serious fiscal expansion in the US, for example, in the same fashion as there was a lot or quite a bit of government intervention when it came to subprime mortgages? Okay. Because a US government definitely had its role to play in this bubble. And if the economic system which we are living in, with government and with banks and everything, is so fragile, what are we going to do about the financial system? How would you put forward the rules for regulating the banks if we want to have a stable economy? Thank you very much.
Yeah, I could go on. The attempt to lay the blame for subprime on government sponsored enterprises is one of those things where there's a little bit of truth in it, but it's something that has some truth, but it's essentially false, and it's ideology that makes people want to make this a government generated problem. But on the broader thing, we have created, in a way, we are in the process of creating a monster. We're creating a financial system that remains inadequately regulated, and yet has what sure looks like a lot of implicit government guarantees behind it. And so we are creating something that could very easily go very badly astray. Now, I don't think we should be worrying a lot about creating bubbles right now. It's just, to say that we need to be clamping down on possible bubbles now, it's an old joke. Jacob Frankel used to like to tell it about the motorist who runs over a pedestrian and says, "Oh, I'm very sorry, let me fix that," and he backs up and runs over the pedestrian again. I mean, they're right now pulling back to trying to undo, reverse everything that got us into this crisis actually makes things worse. But the failure to have effective regulation, if I could have, if there were no political reality and no interest, we should have had a financial reform that was essentially every bit as stiff as Glass-Steagall in the 30s. So we should have had something which was sharply higher capital requirements, much more limitations on what any institution that might have a government guarantee, even implicitly, can do. What we got was something which is not stupid and not bad, but is both kind of weak and much too dependent on judgment. It requires that the Treasury and the Fed actively move to stop what might be excessive risk taking, which current management might do. But the line I always use is, once President Palin appoints Ron Paul as Treasury Secretary, is this going to happen? There's a pretty good chance that we will eventually, that we'll be talking about an even bigger financial blow-up 10 years down the pike. Not a happy. We did let this crisis go to waste in that respect. Yeah.
In many of your columns, and as you stated today, you mentioned that we need to see a larger rate of inflation, in which would lead to economic recovery. However, in the UK, we're seeing quite high inflation, but yet the economic recovery doesn't seem to be coming. Why is that? Why is it that even though the government is pursuing a fiscal policy that's leading to inflation, we're still not seeing recovery? In fact, the latest figures have shown zero growth overall.
My understanding, I read and talk to Adam Posen, so nothing. I'm just essentially parroting, but makes sense to me that of the recent inflation, about a third is the VAT increase. Another good part is commodity prices. Another good part is lagged effects of the depreciation of the pound, and that once you take all those out, it's actually sub. Sub-trend, sub-normal. Wages going nowhere here as in the United States. So I don't think there has been any acceleration, if anything, a deceleration in the underlying rate of inflation, which is what matters for these things. And so you would not expect. There's nothing going on that would be the kind of inflation that would significantly reduce the burden of debt on British households. Right, it's not that kind of inflation. So I think the answer is no surprise. There is a problem. I mean, I'll tell you, among the various things I write about, the one that elicits the most blind rage in readers is attempts to talk about core inflation versus headline inflation. And it's even worse when you start to point out that actually the measures we use of core inflation are themselves imperfect. So that in the United States, we have an uptick in core inflation, but that's actually largely being driven by commodity prices, plus a real quirk in the way we measure housing costs, where because we have so many people have lost their houses, they're having to rent apartments, which drives up apartment rents, which makes the housing cost index rise, even though it's not, anyway. But, there's nothing in the UK numbers. The gods of price index measurement really hate you because they set up a situation which creates the illusion of an inflationary of an inflation problem when that really is not the problem. Adam Posen has said that he'll resign from the MPC if the rate does not come down sharply next year. And if I were on, I would also because I think he's right.
Thank you so much for
asking. Well, thank you.